So it's Monday evening, and here you are at the Buddhist Centre. There's probably 101 different things, 1,001 different things you could have been doing. So, what was it you were hoping for when you left home or left work to come here tonight? So what was it that kind of motivated you? And then when you heard that there was going to be a talk, what went on for you then? And then when you heard the speaker, and then you saw the speaker, what went on for you then? Because actually, what happened, it's interesting, I was at a talk recently, and I realised that there's the speaker, and there's the listeners, and the listeners are just as important as the speaker. So, so here I am, kind of with my nervousness or my excitement, thinking, what am I hoping to get across tonight? What am I hoping to communicate? And actually I feel a sense of relief and I feel quite relaxed, because actually even if I make a right mess of it tonight, you've got the team have got 7 weeks to kind of try and straighten it all out. So I'm going to be talking, Vimalakirti's it's a Mahayana text. Yeah. Now that might mean something to some of you. Oh yeah, Mahayana text. If you know that was a Mahayana text, you probably already knew about the Vimalakirti Nidesha. But just to kind of give me a sense, one of the skills of Vimalakirti, that's the name of the blog, Vimala means pure, and Kirti means radiance, of pure radiance. So there's this sutra, about a guy called Pure Radiance. And it was first, the earliest records are about one of the common era, about 180 common era. But they reckon that it goes back to just the first century. Yeah? So it's about 2,000 years old. Anyway, that was... But I'm interested in, how long have you been coming here? So if you've been coming to the Buddhist Centre, this is your first year of coming along to the Buddhist Centre, please put your hand up. Okay, thank you. If it's your first 6 months of coming along to the Buddhist Centre, put your hand up. Thank you. If you've been coming to the Buddhist Centre for 2 years, put your hand up. Thank you. 3 years. 5 years. 10 years. 15 years. 20 years. 21 years. 22.
25.
So we've got a range of people who have been coming along here for 25 years to people who have been coming here for 6 months. So, now that one of the skills of Vimalakirti, according to the sutra, is that he could teach the Dharma just so as everybody in the audience thought he was speaking to them. Yeah. So, and I kind of somehow, whenever I'm giving a talk, I always sort of think, I've got to try and make it applicable to everybody. And that's going to be difficult with people who have 6 months' experience and 25 years' experience. So I've kind of asked a lot of myself there. And so maybe if I just let myself off the hook about that and just sort of think, if one person, everybody else goes out thinking, now on a Monday night I wish that I'd done something else. But if one person kind of sort of thinks, that was really good, I really got something, then I'll sort of think, and usually it's actually me that gets it. Because I kind of get to read the sutra and I get excited about it and all the different ideas and I sort of think, oh yeah, I could talk about that, that's really brilliant. So, yeah, I need to keep an eye on the time as well. Because one of the things that Vimalakirti does is he can make time stand still. So he can teach for an aeon until everybody has kind of got complete insight. And they don't notice, they think it's just a minute. Yeah. I haven't got that skill yet. So, anyway. So there's this sutra, a Mahayana sutra. So who doesn't know what the Mahayana is? Put your hand up. Okay. So Buddhism has got three main stages. So 2,500 years ago, there was this guy, the Buddha. Buddha means awaken. So he kind of awoke to this insight into how reality is constructed. And he realized that he's connected with everything, and he realized how to become happy, how to be free of suffering. And he wanted to share that. And so he kind of went about sharing it in his life. So for 45 years after he was enlightened, after he woke, he kind of traveled around teaching. And then he died, and the teaching carried on, and it's still kind of carrying on, and it's still kind of developing. And people are still kind of treasuring it, treasuring the Dharma. So the first 500 years, the teaching had a particular kind of flavour. And then there was a renaissance, which is called the Mahayana. So what actually happened then was, so things deteriorate. You know, people start to sort of think, this is the teaching, and it becomes a bit stuck, becomes a bit ossified. But there was people who were still in touch with the spiritual vision, and they kind of wanted to reinvigorate it, and that was called the Mahayana. And so the Mahayana means, Maha means great, and Yana means way, so the great way, the great path. Sometimes it's the great vehicle, but I prefer it as the great path. And they made the distinction between themselves and the Hinayana, the small way, or the small path. And the small path was what they thought was going wrong. There was three main things. One, they thought there was too much emphasis on the monastic way of practicing. So they were critical that actually Buddhism had become too much caught up in a kind of formalism, that you became a monk, and not enough emphasis on actually the inner spirit of practice. Yeah. It was the other thing about that there was some of the teachings they were sort of critical of, in that they were sort of saying some of the what's called the Savastivadins. This is just me being a bit of a smart ass, sort of knowing terms like this. The Savastivadins thought that the ultimate nature of things could be broken down into constituent parts, but the parts that it was broken down to gradually, they were real. That there were existent things called dhammas. And the Mahayana said, no, there isn't. Everything is empty. Everything is empty. And I guess you've heard that if you've been coming along to the Buddhist Centre. Everything is empty. What's it empty of? Yeah? It's empty of fixed self-nature. And so, going back to me giving a talk, you can sort of think, oh yes, there's me, or, you know, you, and there's the speaker, but actually not. There's only experience. There's experience. So you're there having your experience. Now, your experience is shaped by your whole history. So your whole history is present here, and your whole history is also constantly changing depending on your mood. Yeah? So there's nothing fixed about your history either. So you're kind of sat there changing, in a talk that's changing constantly. I don't know where it's going to go. I've got some ideas, and I'm hoping to cover some things, but at the moment it's not going quite where I thought it would. So the Savastivadins had this idea of fixed, and the Mahayana doctrine sort of said, no, there is nothing, everything is empty, everything is process. So that was the second reason that the Mahayana kind of came about. And the third one was the relation to the Buddha. So the idea about the Buddha being, the Buddha was dead, you know, he'd been dead 600 years ago, but the influence was still felt. People could still feel that influence, even though the people 600 years on, 500 years on, had never met the Buddha, or never met anybody who had met the Buddha. But he still loomed large in their psyche. So the Mahayana, you've got this development of what's called the archetypal Buddha. So the archetypal Buddha is kind of like, you can see it as in the potential within you. or the potential within the universe to awakening. Yeah? And it kind of came, this idea of all the different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So the Vimalakirti Nidesha is one of the early sutras that is trying to reinvigorate the spirit, the essential spirit of Buddhism, which is that there is no fixed self, that we are connected. That compassion is what leads to happiness. The realizing that we're connected is what leads to happiness. So this sutra, it's also a bit of a polemic. It's kind of, it's survived 2,000 years basically. This is where I thought I was going to start the talk. I was going to think, I'm very into apocalyptic movies and stories. Anybody else here into apocalyptic movies and stories? Yeah. I kind of, and I often think, what books, it's easy now, I've got a Kindle, but what books would I want to save? What books would I want to see or hope would still be in existence in 2,000 years' time? What books would you want to still be in existence in 2,000 years' time? I'm curious, have a think. And why? I guess you would want a book to be in existence in 2,000 years' time because you thought actually it conveyed values or beauty or truth. Yeah. So has anybody got, anybody bold enough to sort of think, yeah, there's a book I think would be worth 2,000 years' time, I'd want that book still to be around? Any? Yeah?
1984.
Yeah. It'd be very dated then, wouldn't it? But, yeah. Any other suggestions?
An anthology of poetry.
All right. Any particular anthology?
Wide range.
A wide range. Yeah. One of the poetry is great, isn't it? In that it does kind of there's the golden treasure of English verse. It's full of kind of poetry. I don't know if you've come across that particular collection. But you can read John Donne and you can read, you know, the modern poets as well. As, and it's really rich and you can sort of see. Yeah. So any other books?
Resurrection by Tolstoy.
Resurrection by Tolstoy. I've read that. I haven't read 1984. But I've read Resurrection, yeah.
The Dhammapada.
Sorry, the Dhammapada, yeah? The Dhammapada is a collection of short teachings of the Buddha. Yeah? Any others?
I think I want something by P.G. Woodhouse to still be around.
Uh-huh. So anyway, so this the Vimalakirti Nidesha has lasted 2,000 years. So there must be something in it that has kind of been passed from generation that people guarded and passed on. And in fact, the original works are lost, and it was kind of translated. Translated into Chinese, and it also went into Tibetan, and it's kind of come back. And there's different translations, and they're slightly different. But the emphasis is the same. You've got this guy, Vimalakirti, who's a householder. He's a layman. He's not a monk. Anyway, and so how it goes is in chapter 1, there's 14 chapters. In chapter 1, you get the Buddha. And it says, the Buddha is teaching in Amrapali's garden, yeah, in Vaishali. So they're actually historical places. Amrapali was a famous courtesan in the time of the Buddha. It's interesting that courtesan, you know, the idea that actually she was a high-class hooker. Yeah, and she was revered by the Buddha. And there's also in the first chapter, there's the Lichavis. Now, this one of my favourite bits, a little bit from the Pali Canon, is where she owned this beautiful big area near Vaishali, and near there, she had mango groves as well. So she's a very well-to-do woman, and she invited the Buddha for dinner, and she in fact gave the Buddha the bamboo grove, the garden in Vaishali. As a present towards the end of the Buddha's life. So it's kind of is a historical place, and I actually think I've been there. I can't quite remember, but I think I visited it when I was in India one time. But the Lichavi youths, they kind of are on their way to see the Buddha because they want to invite him to dinner. And then they see the Buddha, and they invite him to dinner. And he said, "I've already accepted dinner tomorrow for the with Amrapali." And the Lichvis go, "Damn, beaten by the mango woman." But I quite like that for some strange reason. But so here we go. I'm going to. So this is the Buddha teaching, and it's also interesting in Vaishali. That's not an accident that it's set in Vaishali, because the Savastivadins and the Mahasanghikas met for the first council to decide what teaching should be in the Buddhist canon. Yeah, so it's kind of like there's lots of little in jokes in it. So it's actually very funny, the Vimalakirti Nidesha. There's lots of jokes that you kind of miss, but generally, even you don't need to know anything, you can just appreciate the humour throughout it and the insight. But we start like this. Thus have I heard at one time. Now those of you who have been coming 25 years know that when it says that, it's basically sort of saying this happened at the time of the Buddha. Because all the Pali, all the traditional scriptures start, thus have I heard. So, thus have I heard at one time. The Buddha was in residence in the garden of Amrapali in the city of Vaishali, attended by a great gathering of bhikkhus. There were 8,000, and they were all saints. They were free from impurities and afflictions, and they had attained self-mastery. Their minds were entirely liberated by perfect knowledge. They were calm and dignified, like royal elephants. They had accomplished their work, done what they had to do, cast off their burdens, attained their goals, and totally destroyed the bonds of existence. They all had attained the utmost perfection of every form of mind control. So it sounds a bit like Jedi Knights, that last bit, doesn't it? But what else does it remind you of, reading it like that? No? Does it remind you of anything? No, anyway, I'll carry on and maybe you'll sort of see if it comes. Of bodhisattvas, who doesn't know what a bodhisattva is? You all know what a bodhisattva is? Good. So of bodhisattvas, there were 32,000. That's a lot of them, yeah? So there's 32,000 great spiritual heroes who were universally acclaimed. Later on in the text, it lists them. It doesn't list all 32,000, but it's great reading the names. And I had one of the translations translates the names, and it's kind of like the great holder of the sun and moon in one hand. You know, he who is sitting, in equanimity, he who is sitting in activity, and there's all these names, and they're sometimes quite contradictory, but I forgot that. So, anyway, they were dedicated through the penetrating activity of their great super knowledges and were sustained by the grace of the Buddha, guardians of the city of the Dharma. They upheld the true doctrine, and their great teachings resounded like the lion's roar throughout the 10 directions. Without having to be asked, they were natural spiritual benefactors of all living beings. They maintained unbroken the succession of the three jewels, conquering devils and foes and overwhelming all critics. Their mindfulness, intelligence, meditation, incantation and eloquence, all were perfected. They had attained the intuitive tolerance of the ultimate incomprehensibility of all things. They were expert in knowing the spiritual faculties of all living beings. They were brave, with the confidence that overawes all assemblies. Yeah. So what I get when I read that, it kind of starts to read like a fairy tale. Is that right? That's what I was sort of thinking. And it's kind of like sets you into a kind of, we're into a fairy tale. Now, we probably all know that fairy tales contain insight, yeah? Due to the work of Joseph Campbell. So fairy tales are kind of, passed on through generations, and they contain wisdom that communicates itself to deeper parts of the psyche, yeah? So that's what I see this work doing. It's kind of communicating itself to deeper parts of our psyche. in a kind of playful way, it kind of relaxes you and you sort of... Anyway, so what happens in the first chapter is the first chapter, it's kind of going through that the Buddha's there and there's all these thousands of beings, of all sorts of different beings, so it sets the scene. And then one of the Lichavi youths starts a whole procession, and they give the Buddha these parasols, royal parasols, and each 500 of them make an offering to him of the parasols. And then suddenly the Buddha takes up the first parasol and they're all transformed into one, all 500, and he raises the parasol, and inside it you can see all the universes throughout all the galaxies. And in all of them you see all the different Buddhas doing the same thing and teaching at the same time. It's pretty amazing, you know. Can you imagine being there? So, and so what do you think that's trying to communicate?
Quantum physics?
Yeah, I think it is kind of sort of trying to sort of say, you know, the William Blake thing, in a grain of sand, you can, how does it go? The William Blake, universe, eternity in a moment, and that the universe in a grain of sand. So I think it's kind of trying to get at that, that everything is interpenetrating everything else. Yeah. Anyway, so that's only a kind of sidetrack to the thing. Because then the Lichavi youths, or Ratnaketu, or something like that, he kind of comes to the Buddha and he says, you know, these youths are kind of set on full awakening and they've got a question. How do you purify a Buddha field? Now, a Buddha field is the area of influence of a Buddha. So the concern of the Buddha is the entire universe and galaxies, but their particular influence is their universe, their Buddha field. So how do you purify a Buddha field? And the Buddha says, good question. Indeed, it's a good question, he says. And then he talks about how to purify a Buddha field. And he says, you build a Buddha field with living beings. So actually, here we are trying to build a Buddha field. The London Buddha Centre is trying to use you to build a Buddha field. Yeah. So, and the first chapter is about, oh, that's it, yeah. So they're trying to build a Buddha field. That, you didn't know that. They're trying to build a Buddha field. Now, a Buddha field is pure, where beings are established in happiness, yeah, and compassion and wisdom. So that's what's going on here. Yeah. And even though we're kind of, you know, limited material, we still got to try. Yeah. So you're actually part of this great drama of trying to build a Buddha field. You're here when you sat earlier trying to work on your mind, I guess. You're trying to work on transforming your mind to achieve your full human potential. And you have to then do that with other beings. And so you're part of trying to create this pure Buddha field. Anyway, Sariputra, who happens to be... he's from the Hinayana. Sariputra is one of the Buddha's most principal disciples from the Hinayana. And here he is in this Mahayana text. And he has this thought. Well, if the Buddha's pure, a Buddha field is as pure as the purity of the mind of the Buddha. So the reason why maybe this Buddha field is not so pure is because, you know, the minds of those of us involved, you included, are not that pure yet. But the Buddha, who's teaching this day, his Buddha field should be pure because his mind is completely pure. But Sariputra thinks, this Buddha field's awful. You know, how come, you know, if the Buddha's, if it's dependent on the Buddha's mind being pure, then this is terrible. But the Buddha reads his mind and says, Sariputra, say it is not so. This Buddha field is pure. And then Sariputra gets into an argument with one of the Buddha's disciples, and the Buddha sort of goes, and he touches the ground with his toe, and the whole Buddha field is suddenly seen as pure. And then he touches it again and it turns back into the impure Buddha field. And Sariputra is kind of puzzled. Well, what's going on? And he says, well, the reason why you make it impure is to help human beings. Because if it was pure, they wouldn't feel at ease there. So they make it impure, so they can kind of go, oh yeah, I feel more comfortable here. It's not too bad, is it? You know. So, so the whole one of the themes that runs through the whole sutra is this idea of pure of skillful means. Skillful means. There's going to be a talk. Is it next week you're doing a talk on skillful means? The idea of how do you kind of help beings kind of transcend themselves. You know, so sometimes if you just tell them this is what you need to do, it doesn't work. And I was, in fact, tonight I was really delighted. Lilamani said about me loving football, and I've been organising a game of football for the last 2 years in London, and I wanted it to be Buddhists and friends of Buddhists to come along, but there's very few Buddhists come along, and there's very few Buddhists who are any good at football, sadly. Though for the last 14 years I have been organising a Buddhist football tournament, and it just so happens that tonight one of the guys who came to my Sunday football game, he wanted to meet me to talk about Buddhism. I was completely delighted. And so last night after football we kind of talked about, you know, Buddhism. And then tonight he turns up to the class. And I was kind of like, wow. So my skillful means is really, it's slow. But it's at last my Buddha field. Because one of the things a Bodhisattva does is they develop a Buddha field. And they have a vow that in their Buddha field, this is how they will teach the Dharma. And I have this idea that I really want to teach the Dharma through football. In fact, in chapter 10 of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, they talk about, actually, Sariputra again, he's the fall guy throughout the sutra. He's sort of thinking, when are we going to eat? It's getting near 12 o'clock, and he's a monk, and he has to eat before 12. And Vimalakirti reads his thoughts and says, don't worry, we're going to feed you. And then he says to one of the bodhisattvas, he says, where's the best restaurant? I'm taking liberties with the text now. Where's the best restaurant in the universe? And he says, actually, it's 34 galaxies away. The food there, it's just the smell of the food will feed you for an aeon. Yeah? He says, can we get some? And Vimalakirti, being so magical, kind of brings the food, and they bring one bowl of this food from this universe. And they place it down, and there's the whole thing about how, you know, actually what happens is they teach the Dharma through perfume in that universe. So the food is important, but they have perfume trees, and so anyway, but I've got ahead of myself. But they teach the Dharma through perfume. I've really wanted to teach the Dharma through football. So, second chapter. So the first chapter, Vimalakirti doesn't appear. The second chapter, Vimalakirti does appear. And it starts. No, it doesn't. I haven't got that bit. I haven't written it down in my notes. So, but it starts in that the Buddha, Vimalakirti's in the same city, he's in Vaishali, but he's sick in bed. And he's sick in bed for a skillful means. Because he wants people to come to him. And because he's so famous and renowned, everybody comes to see him in his house. Everybody comes. Kings come to see him, ministers, poor people. One of the things it sort of says about Vimalakirti, that he goes to the brothels to teach, you know, to teach in the brothels. He goes to the gambling houses. He stands at street corners. He's always out there teaching. Yeah, wherever he goes, he's trying to teach the Dharma. But he does it in the ways that kind of is appropriate to the people that he meets. So in the, you know, in the gambling houses, and in the you know, the sports fields, and in the pubs, he's kind of teaches appropriate to those beings. Anyway, so that's chapter 2. He's ill. Start of chapter 3. He's sort of he thinks in his mind, here I am ill. He's having a bit of a joke. Here I am ill, and the Buddha won't even come and see me. And the Buddha reads his mind, because they're having a bit of a laugh with each other. The Buddha reads his mind, and the Buddha says, because I'm here teaching at the moment, and Vimalakirti's ill, he asks his disciples, will you go and visit Vimalakirti? So he goes through these characters who are all from the Pali Canon, the Hinayana, Sariputra. And every single one of them says, I'm reluctant to go and visit that good man. And then you get the story of why they're reluctant to go and visit that good man. And it's usually that they're sort of teaching the Dharma, and he comes along and he confounds them or shows them the limitations of how they're practicing. And then they feel completely lost for words and humiliated. And then Vimalakirti goes off, you know. So it's a whole series of kind of humiliations. And then Vimalakirti Nidesha doesn't just kind of ridicule or tease the Hinayana, it then teases the Mahayana, it teases itself. And then so the Buddha sort of says, having asked all the disciples in the Hinayana, the Pali canon text, and they're all sort of saying, sorry, no, when I went to see him, he kind of said this, or last time I bumped into him, I'm reluctant to go and see that good man. And so you've got that refrain, which is quite lovely. Oh yes, I'm reluctant to go and see that good man. So then the Buddha asks the Bodhisattvas. And you think of the Bodhisattvas, they're going to go. And the first Bodhisattva who he asks is Maitreya, who's supposed to be the next Buddha, and he says, I'm reluctant to go and see that good man. And then he tells a story of why he's reluctant. So then he asks another one, I'm reluctant, and they're all reluctant to go and see that good man, because they've all been, you know, sort of put in, humiliated in some kind of way. But I thought I'd read this one, because I like it, because Mara comes in. Has everyone heard of Mara?
Yeah.
Anybody not heard of Mara? So Mara is the is in Buddhism, is the idea of the evil one, the wicked one. So there's kind of different ways of talking about Mara in Buddhism, but basically he's a character he's a bad character. Yeah? The devil. He's not quite the devil, because you can become a Mara through your bad actions. And then you can kind of, if Mara can develop as well. In fact, in one of the life stories of the Buddha, he was in the realm of Mara, and he was a Mara. And they had to, in this realm where the Buddha was Mara, he had to push these, I don't know whether they were wheelbarrows, but these carts full of burning coals, and everywhere was burning, and the Buddha had to push them. And he was pushing them up this hill, you know, and it's all burning. And then he saw that there was somebody else pushing these burning carts of coals. And he thought, instead of just thinking, God, this is hard for me, he thought, God, that's hard for him as well. And the moment he thought that, he was no longer in that hell realm. He'd gone. And I love that story. It's not in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, but it's a great story, because when you find you're in a negative mental state or a hell realm, if you can manage to sort of shift out and take another perspective for somebody else, you're kind of suddenly out of that realm. But anyway, so the Buddha said to the Bodhisattva Jagatindara. Then the Buddha then said to Bodhisattva Jagatindara, Jagatindara, please go to the Lichavi Vimalakirti to inquire about his illness. Jagatindara replied, My Lord, I am indeed reluctant to go to that good man to inquire about his illness. Why, Lord? I remember one day when I was home, the wicked Mara, disguised as Indra, the god, surrounded with 12,000 heavenly maidens, approached me with the sound of music and singing. Having saluted me by touching my feet with his head, he withdrew to one side. I, thinking he was Lord of the Gods, said, Welcome, welcome, and said to him, You should remain consciously aware in the midst of the pleasures of these eyes. You should often think on impermanence and strive to utilize the essential in body, life and wealth. So that's kind of like a traditional teaching that you would give to people in a god realm. Impermanence. Yeah, impermanence. Mara then said to me, this is Mara, yeah? Good sir, accept from me these 12,000 divine maidens and make them your servants. So he's put him in a... This is a Bodhisattva who's supposed to be beyond all those heavenly pleasures, and he's just kind of warned him about it. And Mara said, well, have all these divine maidens. I replied, Lord of the Gods, do not offer me, who am a religious and a son of the Buddha, things which are not appropriate. it is not proper for me to have these maidens. No sooner had I said these words than Vimalakirti came there and said to me, Noble son, do not think that this is Indra, king of the gods. This is the evil Mara, who has come to ridicule you. Then the Lichavi Vimalakirti said to Mara, Mara, since these heavenly maidens are not suitable for this religious devotee, the son of the Buddha, give them to me. Then Mara was terrified and distressed, thinking that the Lichavi Vimalakirti had come to expose him. He tried to make himself invisible, but try as he might, with all his magical powers, he could not vanish from sight. Then a voice resounded in the sky saying, Evil one, give these heavenly maidens to the good man Vimalakirti, and only then will you be able to return to your own abode. Then Mara was even more frightened, and much against his will, gave the heavenly maidens to Vimalakirti. So then Vimalakirti teaches the heavenly maidens, Mara's daughters, how to practice the Dharma. And so it goes on about practicing the Dharma in that kind of way. So here's Vimalakirti ridiculing the Mahayana. He's ridiculing the Hinayana. And he's kind of sort of taking what's, you know, whatever comes to him, he kind of can turn into the Dharma. He can practice. So how's this relevant? How's this relevant to us? You know, we're not... I've never been offered 12,000 heavenly maidens. Yeah. But I think what this is getting at is the idea of we kind of... we can be rigid in how we practice. We think this is the way. And when you start practicing, there's probably... Initially you start practicing and think this is Buddhism, and you get hold of it and you see that it's changing your life. And you kind of sort of think, yeah, this is it. This is Buddhism. I've got it. I've got it. And when you think you've got it, this is when you need somebody like Vimalakirti to kind of teach you that you haven't. Yeah? So this, and I like this idea of the three levels of wisdom. And the three levels of wisdom is that the first is listening. You listen, you take in the Dharma, or you read it, you take it in, and then you think you've got it, and you practice it. But it's limited. You've got to then find the Dharma in your own words. Yeah? And in that phase of finding it in your own words, it can be quite scary. Have I got it? Because this was so precious to me. You know, the Dharma really helped me kind of make sense of my life. And then you can get rigid about it, dogmatic. And then to kind of start to let go of it and start to become independent and find it for yourself, that's a really tricky phase in the spiritual life. And what you need in that phase, I think, is other members of the Sangha. You need to kind of be bumping up against them and not expecting perfection. And then when you are able to more make it your own, so you find it in your own words, then you can start to find the Dharma everywhere. Yeah? So, 9:30. So, anyway, eventually the Buddha finds somebody to go and visit. The great Manjushri. So, the Buddha then said to the crown prince, Manjushri. Now, Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom. He's supposed to be the wisest bodhisattva of all. And he says, then the Buddha said to the crown prince, Manjushri, Manjushri, please go to the Lichavi Vimalakirti to inquire about his illness. Manjushri replied, Lord, it is difficult to attend upon the Lichavi Vimalakirti. He is gifted with marvellous eloquence concerning the Dharma. He is extremely skilled in the full expression and in the reconciliation of dichotomies. His eloquence is inexorable, and no one can resist his imperturbable intellect. He accomplishes all the activities of the Bodhisattvas. He penetrates all the secret mysteries of the Bodhisattvas and the Buddhas. He is skilled in civilizing all the abodes of devils. He plays with the great super knowledges. He is consummate in wisdom and liberative technique. He has attained the supreme excellence of the indivisible, non-dual sphere of the ultimate realm. He is skilled in teaching the Dharma with its infinite modalities, with the uniform ultimate. He is skilled in granting means of attainment, and so it goes on. Thus, although he cannot be withstood by someone of my feeble defences, still, sustained by the grace of the Buddha, I will go to him and converse with him and see if he's getting well. Anyway, so he goes to Vimalakirti. And he says, there's a whole kind of section. Oh yeah, so when he's on his way there, Vimalakirti sort of thinks, he's on his way now. He'll make his house. And all the bodhisattvas and all the monks and all the other beings, you know, there's 32,000 bodhisattvas, there's 8,000 monks, all the other beings there, they're on the way. And they're sort of saying, this is going to be great. You know, imagine the meeting of Manjushri and Vimalakirti. And Vimalakirti empties his house completely and makes it, though it doesn't make it any bigger or anybody any smaller, there's enough room for everybody to get in there. Right. So, anyway, Manjushri goes to see him, and Manjushri says, householder, whence came this sickness of yours? How long will it continue? How does it stand? How can it be alleviated? Vimalakirti replied, Manjushri, my sickness comes from ignorance and the thirst for existence, and it will last as long as the sicknesses of all living beings. Were all living beings to be free of sickness, I also would not be sick. Why, Manjushri? For the Bodhisattva, the world consists only of living beings, and sickness is inherent in living in the world. Were all living beings free of sickness, the Bodhisattva also would be free of sickness. For example, Manjushri, when the only son of a merchant is sick, both his parents become sick on account of the sickness of their son. And the parents will suffer as long as that only son does not recover from his sickness. Just so, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva loves all beings as if each were his only child. He becomes sick when they are sick, and is cured when they are cured. You ask me, Manjushri, whence comes my sickness? The sickness of the Bodhisattva arises from their great compassion. Householder, why is your house empty? Why have you no servants? All Buddha fields are also empty. What makes them empty? They are empty because of emptiness. What is empty about emptiness? Constructions are empty because of emptiness. Can emptiness be conceptually construed? Even that concept itself is emptiness. And emptiness cannot be construct emptiness. Householder, where should emptiness be sought? Manjushri, emptiness should be sought among the 62 convictions. Where should the 62 convictions be sought? They should be sought in the liberation of the Buddhas. Where should the liberations of the Buddhas be sought? It should be sought in the prime mental activity of all living beings. Manjushri, you ask me why I am without servants. But all Moras are my servants. Why? The Moras advocates this life of birth and death, and the Bodhisattva does not avoid life. Therefore, all the Moras and all opponents are my servants. Now this, for me, is why I love this sutra. And I'm just really going to try and... It may be completely obvious to you, but whenever somebody upsets you, or you find that they're difficult, they are helping you develop your own mind. So if after this talk, you sort of say, that was such a load of rubbish, you know, I have never been so bored in my life, and you wasted my Monday evening, you know, I will have to work with that. And I will be really grateful to you. And I will be humiliated like all the bodhisattvas and all the Buddhas before. because of my ego caught up. So it's kind of like when people upset us, when there are difficulties come before us, that's when we need to start practicing. So that idea that all the Maras in all the hell realms, he says, are really great bodhisattvas helping you practice the Dharma. And I think I'll just sort of, that's the main thing, but the other things that he goes on about is, no, I'll leave it there. That's the end of the talk. But I will take questions.
What did
I leave out? Very skillful. So there's the bit where Manjushri, in the Sariputra, is in the house, and they all arrive, and he says, where's everyone going to sit? And Vimalakirti reads his mind and says, Sariputra, have you come here for the sake of the Dharma or for the sake of a chair? And he says, oh, obviously I've come for the sake of the Dharma. And then the Buddha, Vimalakirti, says, where are the best lion thrones in the whole galaxy, all the galaxies, all the universes? And then somebody says, they're in this kind of place, and they're 32,000 leagues high, and they're lion thrones. And he says, well, we better order some, haven't we? And he kind of brings these lion thrones to the surroundings, and they kind of fit in the house. The house doesn't get any bigger, the house doesn't get any smaller, it doesn't get any crowded, but they all fit in. And all the bodhisattvas can sit straight down on the chairs, but all those hinayana, all those who just follow the small way, they can't get on the chairs until Vimalakirti gives them a blessing and they can go onto the chairs. So that's one bit I missed out. Another bit's the goddess. So this goddess has been living in Vimalakirti's house. She's been living in the top corner, and she kind of comes out and she sort of says, "This is fantastic." And then Sariputra again sort of says, you know, how long have you been living here, goddess? And what you? And then the goddess messes around with him. She kind of showers the whole assembly with flowers. And the flowers land on the bodhisattvas and fall off. But all the monks are covered in flowers. And monks are not allowed to be covered in flowers. And they can't brush the flowers off. And Sariputra's really embarrassed. And then he sort of says, can you take the flowers off? And he gets into dialogue with the goddess. And the goddess transforms Sariputra into a woman and herself into Sariputra to kind of get across the idea that of the limited nature of thinking I'm a man or I'm a woman, and it plays around with that idea. So that's one another bit I missed out, so you won't get to hear about that. And there's another bit towards the end where so Vimalakirti takes everyone to see the Buddha, and they're all excited to go and see the Buddha, and I can't quite remember what happens, but it's something like they decide that they want to show another Buddha realm. And it's the Buddha realm of Akshobhya. And so the Buddha sort of says, okay, we're going to bring this whole Buddha realm down so as everyone can see it, without making it any bigger, without making, you know, this area, you know, without making it any smaller, and without making this area any bigger. So the Buddha's going to reach up, take this universe and bring it to show everybody. Now, as he kind of picks up the universe, Akshobhya's fine. He's kind of okay. Oh, yeah, he knows what the Buddha's doing. But all the beings of a certain level of development, they kind of know that their universe is being moved and they're terrified. But most of the other beings who haven't any development at all, they haven't a clue it's being moved. As far as they're concerned, it's the same. But those ones are kind of terrified, and they say to Akshobhya, no, somebody's taken the universe! And he sort of says, it's got nothing to do with me. Anyway, so that's the Vimalakirti Nidesha, or that's some of the kind of teachings in the Vimalakirti Nidesha. And if you want to read about this, this is Sangharakshita's lectures. It's a book kind of going into some of the stories and sort of drawing out some of the teachings in the Vimalakirti Nidesha. Perhaps one of the other most important teachings is how to create Sangha. And Sangha is created by four means. Yeah? What do you think those four means are? How do you create a Sangha? If you were going about trying to build a perfect community, what would be the four things that you would think are essential?
Seeing
biscuits. Tea and biscuits, yeah. That's kind of, you're on the right track there. Generosity is the first thing, yeah? Generosity. Kindly speech. Then beneficial activity. So doing things that help people is the third. And the fourth is exemplifying. Being, you know, exemplifying what you're talking about. That's how you build a Buddha field. Okay, thank you. Have we got time for questions? 5 minutes. Shall I stop the recording?